Buddy, hello. It is August 6th. I'm DJ Marcus, and I'm here with some news today. So, let's fire up the good old bookmarks. Just take one secola. Going back to work stinks. It's like I'm working, and then I have to jump up and run to the other page. I could record ahead of time, but man, those pre-recorded shows weren't nearly as fun. So, go over here to library, bookmarks. Oh, thank goodness. My air conditioner's been acting up, so it's exposed right now. It's not sound deadened, boo. Anyway, news to me, August 6th. Open in tabs. Perfect. Let's go ahead and jump into com. All right. And away we go. So first up, let's talk about some domestic news, just because I have the most of it, and it is all over the place today. So first up, this is just kind of some drama news, but an MSNBC producer is making news because he's saying that cable news blocks diversity of thought. And Ariana Picari penned a resignation letter on Monday criticizing her network, MSNBC, and other cable news networks, saying that the rating scheme distorts content and causes skilled journalists to make bad decisions on a daily basis. She resigned on July 24th, and ratings had already impacted election coverage, with the network focusing more on Donald Trump and less on Joe Biden. Representative for MSNBC said Tuesday that the network takes public trust granted to us very seriously, and even more so in today's unprecedented news environment. Of course, the right is all over it. Newsmax is saying that producer Ariana Picari blasted the network as a cancer in an open letter. And then they quote her saying, "This cancer risks human lives even in the middle of a pandemic." And then, over on the New York Post, they say Ariana Picari, who worked on The Last Word with Lawrence O'Donnell, shared the letter on her personal site Monday, accusing the network of letting ratings dictate content. And then the middle ground kind of goes a little bit different, and but kind of the same. They just report that, hey, this person doesn't like her job. So, such is life. But it was covered all over the place, so brought it up here for us. Now, continuing the meta about news outlets, Neiman Lab has a bit longer piece about the New York Times. Its subject is, "It continues to be very good to be the New York Times." So last year, Joshua Benton's author, "Last year I outlined what I consider to be the four major milestones a newspaper must eventually reach for its transition to a truly digital company to be successful. And they are: making more revenue from digital sources than print, making more revenue from readers than from advertising, and achieving net value growth with digital dollars rising more quickly than print dollars are falling, and having more digital subscribers than print. This morning, the New York Times became the first American newspaper I'm aware of to reach all four. I only know of one international paper, the Financial Times, that beat them to the title. The Guardian would also be there if it had a true paywall rather than remaining free to all online." And I don't know if I agree. I think I'm glad they don't have a paywall. Paywalls are bad for the world. So the Times today reported Q2 2020 results, and for the first time, a majority of its revenues came from digital, $185.5 million versus $175.4 million from print. So that is some more meta news about the news that I thought was pretty neat. Welcome, SMJ and X1. Hope you guys are doing good. You can always join in the conversation in COM, which is SDF's chat program. Just go ahead and connect to SDF, and then jump into COM. Type COM and hit enter. So let's go through some extra domestic, some domestic news, not about the news. So Dr. Fauci, he's having to, or he's needing security for him and his family because far-right media outlets are targeting Anthony Fauci's daughter with conspiracy theory about her employment. So one of his children works at Twitter, and so far-right media figures, this is from the story, far-right media figures are targeting one of Dr. Fauci's daughters with a conspiracy that claims there's something untoward about a reported employment with Twitter. Misogynist far-right media figure Patrick Howley took credit for his first reporting her employment, and Dr. Fauci has said that he and his daughters have been receiving death threats over his work on the coronavirus pandemic. Attacks on the daughter have been promoted on Alex Jones, InfoWars Network, and are circulating on far-right message board 8kun, which replaces the shuttered 8chan message board. So, sad news there. That was probably not designed by the marketing department. Correcto. So, let's jump on over. Reason has a bit longer piece, but Reason has a great piece about how the United States is not ready to vote by mail, but we're going to have to do it anyway. And so if you want to learn or read about casting votes, I just wanted to mention that. So Ohio's governor tests positive for COVID-19 and has canceled plans to greet Trump in Cleveland. So this is from Reuters. And Ohio's governor Mike DeWine said on Thursday he tested positive and is part of safety protocols to greet U.S. President Trump when he arrives in Cleveland to visit a Whirlpool Washington Machine factory. He was tested as part of the protocol. So a statement issued on his Twitter feed said the governor had no symptoms at the present time and returned to the Ohio capital of Columbus to quarantine at home for the next 14 days. Ohio Lieutenant Governor John Husted also took the coronavirus test and tested negative. So, pretty much a non-story. It's just interesting that people that are in the Trump camp keep getting sick. Alright, let's talk about some sad times, bad times in criminal justice. So, first up, from a news outlet that's slowly growing on me, the World Socialist website, WhiskeySierra.org. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal refuses to hear Socialist Equality Party candidates' appeal in California ballot access case until after ballots are printed. So the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals denied the Socialist Equality Party's appeal to expedite its appeal before the circuit, known as the most liberal in the U.S. In response, the party's candidates, Joseph Keyshore and Norissa Santa Cruz, filed another motion to overturn the denial, which was also rejected yesterday in a one-sentence decision that addressed none of their constitutional arguments. The decision denying the candidates' request for a quick briefing schedule was made by Chief Judge Sidney Thomas, appointed by Bill Clinton, and Circuit Judges Miriam Schroeder and Consuelo Callahan. The ruling and subsequent delay mean that Keyshore and Santa Cruz will be unable to have their names printed on the ballots without having had the chance to have the court address the merits of their appeal. The decision is the latest development in Keyshore and Santa Cruz lawsuit against the state of California. And you can read it on, they go through all the details of the case, but sorry, I was just making sure there's a spot that actually explains what's going on. Okay, so just in general, the reason they couldn't get on the ballot was they didn't get enough signatures. But they couldn't get enough signatures because COVID-19's going on, so everyone's in their house. Yeah, that's pretty much it. You can read the whole details at that website. It's a bit of a drama story. Okay, next up, our friends at Rewire is kind of interesting story here. Judge Allison Jones Rushing, long name, who sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, is one of President Trump's youngest judge picks, having ascended to the federal appellate bench at only 37 years old. Very soft drama. Sorry. To be fair, unlike some of Trump's other picks, Reshing did have some experience with law before getting to the nod for the bench. She spent several years at a Washington, D.C. law firm, but her real appeal was likely that she clerked for then-Judge Neil Gorsuch when he was on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit and Justice Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court. She also spent time at the Alliance Defending Freedom Fund, a well-known it's a well-known group for its anti-LGBTQ stance. So, this is where you need that background to get this, because in a recent ruling, U.S. versus Mitchell, Reshing's animus was aimed at black people. The case started with a bar fight in Huntington, West Virginia. When police responded, a bystander told them a black man wearing red pants and a black shirt had a gun and walked away from the scene. Based on that information, one of the officers stopped and frisked James Mitchell, a black man who was walking a block away. The officer found a firearm and arrested Mitchell. Mitchell appealed, arguing that the police violated his Fourth Amendment right not to be subject to unreasonable search and seizure. The facts of the case weren't great for the police. Officer Benjamin Hauer, who took the report from the bystander, was not the same officer who stopped Mitchell. At Mitchell's trial, more than 4 years later after the incident, speedy trial, my butt, Hauer testified he had no doubt he was on the scene that night as he routinely responded to calls from that bar. However, he also could not specifically remember the night in question and could no longer remember who gave him the description of the man in red pants and a black shirt. There was no warrant, there's no evidence the tip was credible. Particularly since the officer couldn't remember who gave him the tip, there is no particularized suspicion, which is a requirement before the police stop and frisk someone. They can't just stop a person because they feel like it or they have a vague sense the person did something wrong. When police are allowed to stop whomever they want, you get what happened in New York from 2002 to 2011, where police performed 5 million stop and frisks, overwhelmingly of black and Latinx people. Nearly 9 out of 10 of those people stopped turned out to be totally innocent. Additionally, the Supreme Court decided 20 years ago that you can't just stop someone because they happen to be in an area of expected criminal activity, which is really all the police had to go on in this instance. So, she, along with Judge Marvin Quattlebaum, another Trump appointee, held that the officers' actions were fine, in part because they were common-sense judgments and inferences about human behavior. That's a backhanded way of saying it's just fine if police officers are suspicious of black men who happen to be nearby when a fight breaks out. And the fact that Mitchell was carrying a gun? West Virginia is an open carry state, and that doesn't require a license to carry a firearm as long as you're over 18. It was only after the police took Mitchell into custody for crime of walking near a fight and being black they learned he wasn't eligible to carry a firearm because he had a previous felony conviction. So, in the end, Mitchell was, as Wynn put it, simply a man with a gun near a disturbance, and that's not nearly enough to take away someone's Fourth Amendment rights. So this gives police a racist roadmap, get a tip, violate someone's rights and search them, and then hope then after they're arrested you can find justification. So that's a little harder drama, but that's a Marcus upsetting drama. And when Marcus gets upset, you know what happens? Yeah, that's right. We play a song. So, let's go ahead and do that real quick. No, we're not going to play Bachman Turner Overdrive again. I know. I really would like to also, but it's important that we keep you on your toes. This is On the Outside from No Use for a Name.
It's funny being inside, isn't it? Because when you are inside, you're still actually outside, aren't you? And then you can say when you're outside, you're inside because you're always inside your head.
Whoa, so loud.
I'll see you on the outside, it will never be the same. After all that's happened, what is it that we've gained? I made mistakes before and never lived them down.
Second, this music isn't making me calm.
Reality has sunk in and now confirming all my fears. I'm gonna track you down, but it's too late to stop.
You're listening to Anon Radio, powered by the SDF Public Access Unix System.
All right. Well, we got through the U.S. news, and we're just going to blow off the remaining stories from the U.S. because who's got the time? You know what we do have time for?
Is it time for tech news?
We do. It's time for tech news. So, first up, I wanted to give you a special article from that's LWN subscriber-only content. It was posted about a week ago by Jonathan Corbett, and I thought this was really interesting, and if you care about free and open software, you might think it's interesting too. So, NetGPU and the hazards of proprietary kernel modules. So check it out. On its face, the NetGPU patch set appears to add a useful feature, the ability to copy network data directly between a network adapter and a GPU without moving it through the host CPU. This patch has quickly become an example of how not to get work into the kernel, though. It has no chance of being merged in anything like its current form. It's created backlash designed to keep modules like it from ever working in mainline kernels. It all comes down to one fundamental mistake, basing kernel work on a proprietary kernel module. Yeah. The use case for NetGPU appears to be machine learning applications that consume large amounts of data. The processing of the data is offloaded to a GPU. The GPU must be fed a stream of data, though that comes from somewhere else on the network. This data follows the usual path of being read into main memory, then written out to the GPU. And the extra copy hurts, as does the memory bus traffic and the CPU time needed to manage this movement. The overhead could be significantly reduced if the adapter, the network adapter, were to write the data directly into the GPU's memory, which is accessible via the PCI bus. So a suitably capable network adapter could place packet data directly into GPU memory. You with me so far? Yeah, so we're just going to take stuff straight from the adapter and plug it into the GPU and just kind of bypass the messy computer part in the middle. Well, a lot of work has been done in recent years to enable just this kind of zero-copy device-to-device data transfer. So you might expect this functionality to be well-received. And indeed, the code was reviewed normally until the last patch in this 21-part series where things ran into a snag. So, DMA to the network. So, indeed, the code was read until the last patch. This is when the patch that interfaces between the NetGPU module and the proprietary NVIDIA GPU driver. It can't even be built without NVIDIA driver's files on disk. On seeing this, Greg Crow Hartman stopped and complained, "Okay, now you're just trolling us. Nice job. I shouldn't have read the previous patches. Please go get a lawyer to sign off on this patch with their corporate email address on it. That's the only way we could possibly consider something like that." So, yeah, it's pretty insane. It goes on, "This is not in support of proprietary driver. As the cover letter notes, this is for data transfers between the NIC GPU while still utilizing the kernel protocol stack and leaving the application in control. While the current GPU utilized is NVIDIA, there's nothing in the rest of the patches specific to NVIDIA or an Intel or AMD GPU interface could be equally workable." So, goes on down the line of some drama, but the idea here is that this kernel module, on one side of the argument, you say, well, he has an NVIDIA GPU, so that's what he was working with, that's what he based his patches on. The other side says that this is not okay because you are doing something completely different than what the kernel already does. There's the P2P DMA, the DMA buff system, these other existing subsystems that may have achieved its initial goal, but that could have been used to achieve this goal. So the sad part is that by all appearances, the goal of the work was not to add functionality for NVIDIA GPUs in particular. They don't have any obvious connections to NVIDIA, but this is a problem. So then it goes on to basically tell us that there is a... Sorry, I got off topic by getting emotional. Sorry. So, in an attempt to make this sort of mistake harder to make, and surely only by coincidence make life a bit harder for proprietary modules in general, Helwig posted a patch set changing the way GPL-only symbols are handled. Symbols exported as GPL only by the kernel are made unavailable to proprietary modules. There's always been a bit of a loophole, and that a proprietary module can be broken into two parts, one of which is a minimal shim layer that interfaces the kernel and proprietary code. And then if the shim is GPL licensed, it can access GPL only symbols, which then can pass them on. So this patch doesn't entirely close the loophole, but it makes exploiting it a bit harder. Any module that imports symbols from a proprietary module is itself marked as being proprietary, denying access to GPL only symbols. So for as long as the kernel has had a module layer, there have been debates over proprietary modules. In 2006, the development community seriously discussed banning them entirely. 2 years later, a long list of kernel developers signed a position statement stating that proprietary modules are detrimental to Linux users, businesses, and the greater Linux ecosystem. So that was the big heavy tech news. But yeah, kernel development, still a battlefield. Now this is a bit more nerdy, more science-y news than tech news, but Germany is planning to ban floodlights. This comes from MSN.com, but it's AFP is the actual news source. Stupid. MSN and AMP and all this garbage aggregating, stealing content is annoying. So this is AFP. Germany is planning to ban floodlights from dusk for much of the year as part of its bid to fight a dramatic decline in insect populations, it emerged Wednesday. In a draft law seen by AFP, the country's environment ministry has drawn up a number of new measures to protect insects, ranging from partially outlying spotlights to increased protection of natural habitats. So, pretty neato. Greetings, exiled, and CUJKH. Welcome to COM. The OG Colonel Sanders, that made me laugh. Alright, so Blackstone, this is tech business news, Blackstone has acquired Ancestry.com for $4.7 billion. So Blackstone Group said on Wednesday it agreed to acquire a genealogy provider Ancestry.com Inc. for private equity rivals from private equity rivals for $4.7 billion, including debt, placing a big bet on family tree chasing as well as personalized medicine. So this is interesting. Ancestry.com has more than 3 million paying customers in 30 countries and earns more than $1 billion in annual revenue. So it harnessed advances in DNA testing and mobile phone apps in the following two decades to expand its offerings. So, hello Signal 11, welcome back. It is almost time for the Dubious Goals Committee. We've got about 5 minutes, so let's see. Do we got any cool music that I haven't played in a while? I wanna throw something out there. You guys won't like that. Here, this is Practical Amanda, but we'll just play the first 2 minutes, and then I'll read some headlines. See you home. Gotta bring it down with Ben Folds and Nick Hornby. Somewhere easy. Urinals or bedrooms ought to be. Who could be bothered really? You're really good at all that stuff. And bolts of living, curtains, blinds, and kitchen tables. I've got no time for dates and plans. No, I'm too busy dreaming. You're the one with the attention. Practical.
to others.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to Anon Radio, powered by SDF Public Access Unix System.
All right, let's hit some headlines up before Tobe hits us with the GGC. So, scientists have decided to rename human genes to stop Microsoft Excel from misreading them as dates. Sometimes, it's just easier to rewrite genetics than update Excel. There are tens of thousands of genes in the human genome, and The Verge is reporting that 27 human genes have been renamed, all because Microsoft Excel kept misreading their symbols as dates. So, that's pretty funny. Scientists have created the brightest known materials in existence. So a major breakthrough with fluorescence has allowed scientists to create the brightest known materials in existence. The advance paves the way for a new class of materials that transform fluorescent dyes into solid objects. According to researchers from Indiana University in the US and the University of Copenhagen, there are more than 100,000 fluorescent dyes in existence, but until now, it was not possible to mix them in a predictable way in order to produce solid optical materials. So that's pretty rad. I think it's cool. Super rad. And just a couple other extra headlines. The Canada Zoo is struggling to find enough bamboo to feed its pandas. They tried to return them to China, but alas, China is not accepting returns right now because of the coronavirus. So poor pandas are going to get so hungry. I'm sad about it. Shout out to Tobe. It's looking like we're going to have a busy calm day and a non-radio day. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow. Oh, that's so loud. Well, that sound means that our time's come to an end. Thanks for listening. I'll be back tomorrow and every weekday, Monday through Friday, before the Dubious Goals Committee with Tobe. At 1900 UTC. Talk to you then. Shout out to Jazzmaz. I didn't see you till now. Huh. I still have like 10 seconds or less. We'll just kind of hang out for a minute. Do, do, do. Do, 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 do. Do, 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 do.